Session number 13265, reel number 17.
Reel 17.
On the Halifax, this part of the takeoff required physical effort on the part of the pilot to get the tail up. And if the throttles were opened evenly, all four engines opened evenly, then because of the torque from the four propellers all revolving in the same direction and the resultant air blast on the rear end of the aircraft, on the fins and rudders, then the aircraft would swing rather violently, and in fact it was possible to do quite hairy ground loops, especially on a frosty runway. And so it was necessary to develop the technique of opening the throttles in echelon, so that you produced almost a 45 degree opening with one, I can't remember whether it's starboard or port engine, flat out, and the inboard engine from it slightly less so, and the engines on the other wing almost hardly opened at all, and use the resultant blast to get the tail up, and then when the kite gets rolling, to open up the other throttles nicely until you have all four throttles wide open, the engines flat out, and you're belting down the runway for takeoff. Well, these two chaps, who'd been flying twins previously, seemed unable to get the hang of it. And on one or two interesting occasions, in fact, they opened up the throttles in echelon in this fashion, opposite way on, which, of course, made the problem even worse. It just beggared everything up, and we had one or two quite hair-raising manoeuvres on this runway and off it, of course, as well. So hair-raising, in fact, that for several days, I think I took over the throttle operation from them and let them just concentrate on getting the kite off the deck. It was when we were on night flying that became most interesting, of course, because doing it in daylight is one thing, but swizzling down a runway in a series of tight ground loops at night is something else again, especially when you're bearing in mind the thought of all that barbed wire and the Nissen huts at the far end. And it was whilst I was flying with these chaps, we, as I recall, Cheshire, I know Cheshire was in the aircraft. This is one of those events which makes me wonder whether we were in fact at Leconfield or Marston Moor or where we were, because I can't remember where Cheshire was at this time, but Cheshire was certainly flying with us, and he was due to pass these bods out. And we'd taken off and done a couple of circuits and landings at night, and Chesh walked past me and said, "Well, it won't be long now, Corporal." And I didn't realise, but he stepped out and walked out of the kite and left me in here so that these two bods could do solos. Well, we got off and we were getting into the circuit quite nicely, and I popped my head up into the dome over the engineer's position and have a look round from time to time. But mostly I'm keeping an eye on temperatures and pressures and so on, and making sure that I'm opening the radiator shutters so that temperatures are where they should be. And suddenly there's a sort of a whoomp, and the whole kite shuddered and shook and whatnot, and I whipped up into the dome to have a look out, and there was a Whitley in a horrible attitude in the sky, staggering past, and it was apparent that we'd had a near miss, and very near from the way our kite had been shaken up. Well, the two pupils, the sweat stood out on their faces and went woof, ran down their faces, ran down their backs. And where the Whitley had come from, I don't know, and whether we should have seen it or not, I really don't know. But that was one of those efforts when you were sort of as close as that to buying the farm, and we completed the circuit and landed reasonably well, and dawn was coming up shortly afterwards, and I was glad to see the back of that night. Whilst I was at Leconfield, we had, I don't know who the instructor was, but we had a Canadian pilot, Flight Lou. I think he must have come to us, I think we must have been converting the Whitley squadrons at Pocklington at this time, onto Halifaxes. And my aircraft at this time was on a hard standing on the airfield, in a place where the airfield opened out. There was the perimeter track. If you came from the hangars, it was on the left-hand side of the field. Geographically, I can't place it, but on the left-hand side of the field, and the field opened out with a left-hand, right-angled turn, and in the corner of this right angle, which enlarged the field, was the hard standing off the perimeter track where my aircraft stood. There were two or three large trees around this area and a tall hedge. So that anyone coming up from the hangars along the perimeter track would see our Halifax from a distance above the hedge, but in a car might not have seen it, or from anywhere relatively low down would probably not might not have seen the aircraft, but of course they would know that there was an aircraft there, because people using the airfield knew which hard standings were occupied. We were on this hard standing, and as was customary, the aircraft was tail in towards the airfield. You didn't usually run up with the blast from the run-up blast out of the airfield into the next fields. It's not considered to be polite or decent to be blowing gravel and grit all over people who might be outside the hedge, if anyone were outside. So we were there, and we were getting ready to go out onto the field to take off for circuits and bumps. And I'm in the engineer's position, and I pop up into the dome and have a good look round, and I can see nobody behind us and no aircraft taxiing behind us. So I give the word to the pilot, who is just he's actually behind me, but in terms of the aeroplane is in front of me, because I'm standing with my back to him, looking at the instruments on the panel. I give him the word to run up, so that he can run each engine up and to full bore, check the boost pressures and revs and so on, and check the mag drop. So we run an engine up, and okay, and I pop up and have a look, and we run the next engine up, and okay, and I pop up, and we run. And suddenly, in the middle of a run-up, I had the curious feeling that I ought to be looking out at the back. So I popped up to see what was going on, just in time to see a tiger moth in the air, on its back, about 4 feet off the deck. We've just blown it over. It had obviously taxied across behind us, and we've blown this thing over, and I catch it in midair, just as it's blowing over. And we very quickly find out that it's the station commander in his own personal tiger moth, which has just had a top inspection of some sort. It's just been recovered and repainted, and it's all nice and prissy. And we've blown it on its back, and he isn't happy. And he's hanging there in his straps, yelling and for somebody to get him out and so on, because he doesn't have a lot of clearance. If he lets go of the straps, he's going to rattle his head on the concrete on the ferry track. Interesting it was. And So we stopped running up, and we didn't go take off for the exercise. And he took the view that it was our fault. And he had the, of course, he had everyone concerned into his office for examination, and I gather that the poor old flight Lou got a severe dig for it, a severe reprimand, and as you know, a severe reprimand affects his promotion. It delays it a bit. It's going to cost him a few pennies in terms of increase in salary, because he doesn't get his promotion for another 3 months or whatever. And even though I made the point that we'd carried out the necessary drills correctly and so on, the station master, of course, wasn't going to accept that it was all his own stupid fault, because it was up to him to check up. He should have been able to see from the grass and so on and the hedge behind us in front of him that an aircraft was running up. He should have been noted that there was a Halifax there and seen the engines running as he taxied along on the peritrack. And it's really, when an aircraft is parked and being run up, it's up to other folks to stand clear. But no. Anyway, yeah. I suppose, I don't know if that went onto my records, documents or not. But I imagine he might have been spiteful enough to do that. Another incident that occurred in connection with this chap was one of our instructors, was sent upon NFT to check an aircraft out. This was at a time when we were being called in for operations, you know, milk runs and things of that order that were also done as part of the conversion course. And, all right, the aircraft was NFT'd, night flying test. Night flying tested and checked out. Okay, on the operation that night, as I say, I don't know whether it was Germany or the milk runs were usually the French coast, Boulogne and places like that. The aircraft returned and the pilot marked it unserviceable. I forget why, whether it was an instrument or whatever it was that he said was faulty. Anyway, he claimed it unserviceable. And the next time, he came back with the same story. And so the ground crew were told to check it out. Well, they ran the aircraft and they did everything they could. And they did. They did another NFT. And nothing showed up. And the kite went on an operation and came back again. At which time the station CO, so we heard, this may be, it may have been scuttlebutt, but the word got around that the station CO had accused this pilot of being yellow. And so he took the aircraft up for an NFT and passed it. I said, there you are, the aircraft's all right. And everybody said, yes, well, of course, that's what happened before. All right, says he, so I'll take it on the operation. So he did, and he came back with it unserviceable too. And had to apologise to the bud he'd been chewing off earlier. Just one of those things, this kind of thing can happen with aeroplanes. You can check, but unless you do exactly what has been done before, where the fault has shown up, unless you do exactly the same thing, you don't necessarily produce the result. There was a WAF, by the way, there was a WAF at Leconfield. She was a New Zealander. And why she wasn't flung out of the service, I don't know, because apparently she'd either got or had TB. And she was attending the sick bay. But you may remember that sometime, I think in 1940 or early 41, a rigger who'd been sitting on the rear end of a Spitfire whilst taxiing had been taken up into the air, and the pilot had found the kite was tail heavy, and eventually he'd done a couple of circuits and landed the aircraft with this character still sitting aboard. It happened. It could easily happen. I think I mentioned that the Spitfire was tended to be rather nose heavy on the ground in taxiing, and people had to on grass fields people tended to have to sit on the tail end whilst the pilot taxied up to the end of the runway and so on. Well, this WAF, this girl, had heard about that, and I'm quite certain in my own mind, and from one or two things she said that reinforced it, that she was determined to have a go at this. And there was a Spitfire squadron. This was before we got to Leconfield. There'd been a Spit squadron there, and she'd had to sit on the rear end whilst taxiing. I have an idea she'd straddle the fuselage facing the fin. Anyway, when it came to the end of the runway and the pilot ran up for takeoff, she didn't get off, and she went round on it, and of course gained a considerable notoriety as a result of this. She was as daft as a brush, she really was. But one of the things that can happen, and of course she could easily have fallen off and killed her stupid self. On January the 1st, the word came out that we were being, that the unit was going to be changed again, and we were also moving to Marston Moor. So the advance party, we were all elected to ride on the Queen Mary's as advance, and ride with stores and spares over to Marston Moor. And we did this on New Year's Day, 1942. The temperature was considerably below freezing, if you check the records, on that day. And by the time we'd travelled from Marston Moor to Linton-on-Ouse, starting at about 9 o'clock in the morning, sitting or lying or hanging on the outside of Queen Mary's with no shelter and protection at all, we were absolutely frozen stupid. It was a wicked journey. You know what the Queen Mary's are, do you?
I think we put it on record earlier.
Those 60-foot long low loaders and so on. Yes. Had I mentioned that earlier?
I think so.
We arrived at Marston Moor and discovered it to be a dispersed station. The usual airfield with runways, Bellman type hangars, that's the corrugated iron, corrugated steel, sheet steel covered hangars. No centralisation at all. Billets were dispersed around the station in the form of Nissen huts, and the ablution blocks and dining room and cookhouse and so on, separate from the billets. And this place had of course been built during autumn and the approach of winter. There was mud everywhere, although at the moment it was frozen solid. The billets were unwelcoming. Curiously enough, they were still building Nissen huts with windows in and painting them black. I could never understand why you had to put windows in to paint them black. Why not just build a brick wall? In view of the fact that we might get bombed, it would have made a lot more sense. But that's the way the official mind works. It was quite a long walk from the billet to toilets and wash places. A very long walk. And quite a long walk from there to the dining hall. And then a considerable walk from there to the flight officers. And of course, having got through all that palaver first thing in the morning, It was then a considerable walk from the flight officers out, or the hangars, out to the aircraft, which were dispersed around the airfield. The end result of all this is that there was a considerable demand for bicycles. And so bicycles began to be issued out, first of all to the, obviously, officers and senior NCOs, and then the corporals seemed to qualify, and NCOs IC aircraft, and eventually there were even bicycles for some of the very low orders. This, of course, introduces other problems, because on a station where bicycles are in effect a necessity for getting around, anybody who hasn't got a bicycle is quite apt to use any bicycle he sees standing empty. And so bicycle theft became an interesting problem on the station, and bicycles had to be numbered and locked up and fastened, or it was, the whole thing was a pain in the neck. But of course, winter in Yorkshire and long distance walking is also a pain in the neck. So everyone tried to keep their bicycle and keep things under decent control. I think it was here, I may have mentioned Willie Tate and his red silk lined uniform and so on earlier. I was working on an aircraft where it was so cold that I couldn't feel the spanners, and I was shearing studs on the coolant pump. And after shearing a couple of sets and struggling like crazy and just about in desperation, Willie Tate hopped up onto an engine stand and actually did the job for me, despite the grease and mess. I think I described that. Well, I'm fairly sure that that actually happened at Marston Moor rather than at Linton-on-Ouse, which would have been 12 months earlier. It's not greatly important. Well, we've mentioned the business of the undercarriage door mods occurring. Happened, and did I mentioned the 1,000 bomber raids to Cologne, did I?
Do I think so?
Ah. Well, when that occurred, I was at home on the 48-hour pass. Leonard Cheshire offered the Dickey seat, the second pilot's seat on his Halifax, to anyone who would care to go on the raid as a passenger. But he offered it around his own ground crew for a starter, and then around that generally, but he didn't get any takers. And I was a bit miffed about that when I got back, because I'm quite certain that if I'd been on station and the word got around, I'd have had a do at that, because I don't think anybody ever thought that Leonard Cheshire wouldn't come back. You know, he was regarded as being one of those chaps who would always come back. But on the next raid after that, shortly after, when they did a follow-up of a 1,000 raid on Essen, the station commander decided to go as a passenger. I've forgotten his name. Not Blackadder, Blackwood, Black something, Blackmore. Anyway, I may have mentioned that Cheshire was interested in trying to bomb targets more accurately, and that he'd tried dive bombing in a Halifax. Well, he was still interested in, and I think he was beginning to think about target marking and so on. And after he'd finally dropped his bombs, and he was quite happy to make two or three runs to get it right, he then proceeded to orbit the target well under the kites, which were bombing from a higher level, and he proceeded to orbit the target, taking notes and observing what was happening. And there was a considerable amount of flak about at the lower level at which he was flying. And eventually the station CO says, "For Christ's sake, Chesh, get the hell out of here." He says, "I've had enough of this." And it was quite a sensible attitude, I think, under those circumstances. And they came out and came back. And when the kite was... when they got out and they walked around and had a look at the kite and the ground crew, of course, always checking for damage, there were about 13 fuel leaks on it where the tanks had been perforated by shrapnel and so on from flying flak. The self-sealing tanks are only nominally self-sealing. They stop a flow of fuel from a hole in the tank, but if there's any amount of fuel in the tank,